All right. Hey, one of our favorites back on the show. Been too long. Jesse Simonton. You know him, of course, from the Surrender Cobra Substack. Jesse, how you been, man?
Doing well. Trying to stay warm. It's dipping into the sub-freezing temps at this morning in Florida, too. So trying to get it up north of 40 if we can.
Well, I'll tell you where it is warming up pretty quickly, Jesse, and you wrote about it, so you know all about it. But that'd be old Baton Rouge with Lane Kiffin dominating the transfer portal once again. Man, does this immediately make LSU with Lane Kiffin a contender, you think, next season in the SEC and of course, the college football playoff?
Well, they better be, right? I mean, that's why he left a team that he said he didn't think could win a championship. They won two more playoff games, and he has on his resume. And now he's going to a school that, besides Brian Kelly, every other coach, you know, their last three coaches have won not only an SEC championship, which Lane has never done, but they've won a national championship. And that's the expectations. You know, it's funny, Mike, because you can't frame it the same. But the guy that Lane Kiffin is replacing, Brian Kelly, basically he is doing what Brian Kelly did. Brian Kelly left Notre Dame because he decided that he could not win a national championship at Notre Dame. Marcus Freeman in the very next year was like, bet, and got Notre Dame to the national championship. They didn't win, but he got them there. Lane Kiffin just left a situation where they arguably would have built him a statue in Oxford if he stayed for even just five more years. Let's say he's there for 5 years and then goes to the NFL, or maybe he finally gets that, you know, Alabama job that I think he so secretly, you know, has pined for. But instead, you know, he's deflected and said, you know, Nick Saban told him he had to take the job, and other people in his camp told him he had to take the job. Just completely, frankly, whitewashing, you know, 6 months of, you know, Lane Kiffin propaganda from ESPN and CAA and everybody else, where they said that he was a changed man. And he's not. He's Lane Kiffin. And we love him and hate him for it. And he has, I think, to his credit, been successful. I mean, there was a reason why he was the number one coach on the market this cycle. And it's because the best guys just aren't leaving. You're not going to get Dan Lanning. You're not going to get Kirby. You're not going to get Ryan Day. And so even though Lane Kiffin's resume, frankly, you could make the case that no one has failed forward better than Lane Kiffin. I mean, he just got the LSU job, and that might not be the top three job on his resume. I mean, this is a guy that coached at USC, coached the Oakland Raiders, you know, was at Tennessee, you know, when Tennessee still believed that they could be, like, you know, one of the kings of the SEC coming off Fulmer. And now he's at LSU. And so he has done, to your point, kind of what was a long, long preamble to say he's done what I thought he was going to do. And to his credit, you know, he has dominated the portal again, whether he's the self-dubbed portal king or other people want, you know, whether it's Cignetti or whoever, Lane Kiffin crushed it. And not only did he rebuild LSU's quarterback room, but he's completely, I think, unlike Brian Kelly, retooled everything around the quarterback. He's made sure that they, you know, have a bunch of new offensive linemen. He's made sure that they're going to have receivers, the defensive line. He's attacked the edge. The LSU, I think, finally is going to have some pass rush next season. But now you got to win games. That's the easy part. Lane Kiffin going on Twitter and you know, whether he tampered or whatever, you know, doing the Lane Kiffin stuff. He's going to have to prove that something that he hasn't done, which is, frankly, on a regular basis, win games against top five and top 10 teams, because that's what it's going to take in a playoff era to win a national championship.
Yeah, and that's got to be the standard for what they're paying him, what they're putting in this roster. But how realistic do you think that is, Jesse, with all the moving pieces now? I think you could easily point to Ole Miss and say, well, he kind of did something similar, maybe not to this degree, because, you know, it's a year one takeover, so it's going to be more players coming in. But specifically offensive line, quarterback, receiver, is it realistic to have all these pieces meshed together into a not a playoff contender, but a playoff team? Because that's what the fans are going to be demanding.
Well, that's what the fans are demanding. That's what they're paying him for. And that's what Kiffin whether he wants to, you know, I don't think Lane actually wants to embrace the villain role. The fact that he kind of played a little bit of the victim post kind of the fallout of Ole Miss leads me to believe that he likes, you know, making the Twitter jokes and likes being the troll. But when it's kind of the spotlight is kind of circled back onto him, where, you know, it's everybody else against Lane Kiffin, I don't think he really likes that. But he is under, I think, more pressure next season in 2026 than any year of his coaching career, basically since USC. He's had kind of a free roll at Ole Miss, and he's done an excellent job. I mean, he is the greatest, you know, head coach in Ole Miss history. But now he's got 50 new faces. I think it's around 52 or 53 new faces on an 85-man roster that he's going to ask to come together and win an SEC championship. The talent on paper says that they could do it. Their schedule, I think, is trickier than some believe, because I think, you know, a game at Ole Miss is going to be it's going to be a snake pit because of everything around Lane Kiffin. I think it's going to be another circus when he comes back to Tennessee, whether they're throwing golf balls at him or mustard bottles or whatever. He's going to be swimming in it. And then, you know, frankly, again, he has to do what we have not seen him do routinely. And with these 9-game SEC schedules, everybody's going to have a hard slate. No one's going to have a free pass. So you're going to have more of these top 5, top 10 games. And he just frankly has underwhelmed in a lot of those performances. Then when you add in the fact that I do think there is a little bit of uncertainty at the quarterback position, they did get the number one guy, or according to most rankings, the number one guy in the portal. It worked out well for LSU the last time they got the quarterback from Arizona State. It wasn't the first year, it was the second year. But Jaden Daniels didn't win an SEC or national championship because the pieces around him weren't good enough. I do think the pieces around the quarterback position at LSU are vastly improved. I think the roster is a lot better than it was a year ago. But the fact that there is kind of some rumblings behind the scenes that maybe there's some, you know, added injury concerns, which is why they went so aggressive at getting Husan from USC. Really nice piece, but you're talking about a first-year starter amid all these expectations and pressure. And that'll probably lead to some of these other conversations, but I think that's a similar balance and tricky line, you know, that tightrope that I think some of these programs are trying to walk. Alabama is in this camp. I think Tennessee is in this camp. And LSU, if Sam Leavitt is not healthy, or if there is a lingering setback, you're either looking at Husan, or, you know, is Lane Kiffin trying to pull a rabbit out of his hat twice, and that's why they got the kid from Elon, and they hope that he can be kind of Trinidad, you know, Chambliss 2.0. We're coming up from the, you know, Division II, and suddenly you find lightning in a bottle. That's a lot of what ifs. We just went through a lot of what ifs. And so I think, and that's what I kind of wrote about, Lane Kiffin, it's always a drama. It's always a soap opera. And LSU's 2026 season is a TV show I want to binge. That's something I want to see, and I'm excited to watch.
Yeah, no doubt. Now this is not specifically aimed at LSU, but I think it's, you know, it's easy to kind of point the finger at them. But I was talking to someone the other day, and they told me the LSU roster is at least a $40 million roster this year, which I think is accurate. What happened to this 20 something cap we have, and what happens if these deals don't get approved? I mean, again, this is not specific to LSU, because I think we could throw 10, 20 teams into this bucket. Are there going to be any repercussions if this is NIL go? This is a committee that's supposed to be approving all these NIL deals. Are they just, I mean, is there no enforcement? Is there no, what's your thoughts on all that?
I mean, right now, doesn't it seem like, Mike, that everybody is driving 90 in a 70, and then there are a couple schools that say, I'm going to go triple digits on you. I'm going to go 100, and I dare you to pull me over. Let's see what happens. And let's see if you either are fast enough to catch me, or if you do catch me, I'm going to get my day in court, and we'll see what happens. Because that's certainly how it seems. You got Clemson out here riding 75. They're trying to follow the law. And, you know, they didn't really have receipts, but Dabo claimed he had receipts, but we haven't seen them yet. And so that's kind of hurting, you know, that's why it's a lot of folks are, and specifically Ole Miss folks, are saying, cry me a river. Now, if you got the text messages, let's see them. If you don't, keep on trucking. And I just think you have the Ole Misses and the LSUs and the Texas Techs and, you know, Oregon's up there. I think they're all, you know, driving 85, 90 in a 70, and they're kind of daring folks to get them pulled over. Because right now, that enforcement, that NIL go, it just, it has no bite. It has no teeth. And right now it's just kind of an empty threat. And I think that's why you just see some of these programs that have the cash. If LSU's got a $40 million roster this year, I would think that Texas, even if Arch Manning is allegedly not getting a dime because of he's gotten all of his glasses money, you know, but Warby Parker's paying him all that money so he can look like, you know, look like Kent, play like Superman on Saturdays or whatever. Even if they're not giving him a dime, Texas has got to have a $35, $40 million roster too. So they're zooming in the 90s right with LSU. So these schools that have these, you know, billionaire backers or oil money or whatever it is that's allowing them to do these rosters, they're not worried about any repercussions. They'll ask for penance later if the NCAA or whatever arm is able to actually say, hey, we will enforce the rules that are set out to be as such.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I can imagine a world where Dabo retires or gets fired or whatever if Clemson's really bad, and then he is leading NIL go enforcement. How about that?
Yeah, my point, Dabo would be like Barney Fife. Yeah. Dabo would be like, he may mean well, he may be a nice guy, but they're going to run over him. They're going to run right over him. And Barney Fife, he may shoot off the gun a little bit prematurely, and then he's going to have no more bullets to fire because Andy ain't going to give him one. And so then what's Dabo going to do? And I think that's just kind of where it is right now.
Yeah. Well, you said, the NCAA, NIL go, they got no teeth. Well, who else had no teeth last season was South Carolina after an off season of hype. They entered the season, I believe they were like
top 10.
Yeah. Okay. I was going to say 15, but top 10, man, they were up there and they failed spectacularly. Now they're bringing back a lot of key pieces, of course, Sellers and Dylan Stewart and Nick Harbor. And I really do like the offensive coordinator hire of Kendall Briles. But what's your thoughts on the offseason there in Columbia?
See, I don't like the offensive coordinator hire in Kendall Briles. I think that he's kind of – if we're continuing the analogies here, I think he's kind of like the viper in the quicksand, because it seems like wherever he goes, the coach that he's working for ain't doing so hot that next season. I would also ask KJ, you know, have Sellers talk to KJ Jefferson how that worked out for his quarterback development. I do think it's a boon for South Carolina that they did retain all these guys. And that is a major credit to Shane Beamer and their NIL collective. You know, everyone, I think it was a foregone conclusion behind the scenes that everyone thought Sellers was going to Miami by Thanksgiving. And it didn't happen. They kept him, and they kept Dylan Stewart on the roster, and they kept the former five-star offensive lineman. I think your buddy Marler tweeted out that this is going to be maybe their most talented roster or the highest blue chip ratio roster they've had, you know, since the heyday of the Spurrier, Connor Shaw, Lattimore, Clowney, all those guys, those teams, in the 2011 era, 2010. So that's all the positive for South Carolina. The negative is that the schedule is what the schedule is. And if you look at, I think even the most optimistic South Carolina fan, I don't know, Chris is a South Carolina guy, right? I mean, yeah. Even the most optimistic South Carolina fan would look at that schedule and say, is South Carolina favored in more than two SEC games? I don't think so. They're not going to be favored against Alabama. They're not going to be favored even – I think Florida is going to be a sneaky, you know, dark horse top 25 team by the time the fall rolls around. They're not in very many – too early top 25s, but when you look at what they retain and the talent on that roster, plus what John Summerall's brought in and just the upgrade coaching on Saturdays, Tennessee, Oklahoma, A&M, Georgia, Clemson to toss up. I mean, I think that other than Arkansas and Kentucky, and you could make the or Arkansas, Mississippi State, excuse me. You know, I'm not sure South Carolina's favored in another, you know, game against a Power Five opponent all season. And that's tough. I mean, that's just tough.
You just hate Beamer. That's what it is.
I don't, man. I like Shane a lot, man. I've sat down with Shane several times. I mean, I think Shane's a good guy. And I was honestly surprised that he did not more aggressively push to kind of parachute his way back to Va Tech this offseason. And maybe that's a credit to him too. I mean, he's been, you know, where a lot of these coaches are phony and fake. I think Shane is kind of unabashed. I've said this before. I think he's unabashedly Shane Beamer. He's kind of a goofball. He's kind of a, you know, a weirdo, but he's a super nice guy. And he's kind of transparent about, you know, that he's kind of different. And the fact that, you know, what was it? I mean, it was a terrible Netflix show, but the behind the scenes, you know, that show that came on last year, I think you were on it, right?
Yeah,
you
that and was Andy a, Staples fanta- and that was the that. Best Netflix show ever made. What
no, but it was
about?
Not. It was not. It, y'all had some nice performances, but it was not. The problem was they did not give us enough really good insight. But I do think that, you know, Shane's wife going on there and being like, "Hey, the reality is we're probably going to get fired," and that's just, you know, that's a reality for most coaches, but it is absolutely a reality when you look at South Carolina's history. That you're not working at South Carolina to get a bigger and better job. You're working at South Carolina to maybe get some generational wealth for your family. And then you're looking for a new gig maybe 5 or 6 years down the road. So Shane faces it. South Carolina and Shane face an uphill battle. They've won, you know, you could say they've won the battle this off season, but I think ultimately he's probably going to lose the war. And I would be surprised if South Carolina is not in the market for a new head coach in 2027.
Mm-hmm. Well, hey, speaking of another couple of jobs that could open, I don't know if you saw it. I recently did my SEC hot seat rankings, and I didn't put these. I put these three guys in their own class.
You had them in fours, right? I think I saw like a short video.
No, I have them at threes.
Threes, okay.
And that means in my mind, you know, they're not in danger of getting fired. But they're not necessarily on a cool seat either. And I'm talking about Steve Sarkisian at Texas, Josh Heupel at Tennessee, and Kalen DeBoering down there at Alabama. Again, all these guys, good coaches, but expectations are sky high. And what's your thoughts on these three in particular? And would you agree that that each of them in their own unique way is kind of at a little bit of a crossroads at their current tenure?
Crossroads is a great way to frame it. And when you add the context that no one entered last season thinking that James Franklin was a guy who could get it fired, Penn State's ranked, you know, number two in the country in preseason polls. They kind of tried to pull a 24 Ohio State, excuse me, where you pay buku money to bring back all your guys. So they bring back Singleton, Allen, you bring back the quarterback, Drew Allar, you bring back all those defensive linemen, you pay Jim Knowles a crazy sum of money to leave the reigning national champions to come to your school. And then you just, what is the nice way to say it? You shit the bed. I mean, that's what they did. They just completely, it was a cluster. It became so untenable in Happy Valley that they just said, "That's it. You've won a lot of games, James, but we got to move on." And James Franklin is more successful long-term than Steve Sarkisian has been in his career. He's been more successful than Josh Heupel has been. Kalen DeBoer has an unbelievable record. A lot of that, obviously, at smaller schools, NIA schools, Whitewater moving on up. But he was very successful, obviously, at Washington to be able to get the Alabama job. But I think you're right. I mean, I think all three of those coaches are on varying degrees of, if not now, when. Sark, Texas ain't holding them. Texas has pushed their chips to the table. This is a all-in season for them in 2026. You look at, again, we alluded to what they've paid for the roster. Take a peek at some of these early NFL draft boards. They may have as many as five first rounders. Who's another school that had as many as five first rounders a year ago at this time? Clemson. How did that go? I mean, just because on paper it looks like this could be a magical season, you still got to go out and win. The move that Texas made, that Sark made, to fire Pete Kukowski and then hire Will Muschamp, I think was fascinating. I like Will a lot. I think Will is a really great defensive coordinator. How does he look away from Kirby, though? His track record recently has not been that great, aside from when he's been, you know, with Kirby and Glenn Schumann. And there's also the frankness, Mike, that look at the raw stats. Defense hasn't been Texas's problem the last 2 years. It's that the offensive numbers have fallen behind what the talent has been on that side of the ball. Now, you get Cam Coleman. They paid who knows how much money, you know, to get arguably the number two receiver in the country. You have, you know, Mr. Warby Parker, Arch Manning coming back. And I think you're going to see a better Arch Manning. Why wouldn't you? Then, you know, set another year in the system, you know, another year behind that offensive line. You get Hollywood Smothers, who is awesome. You get Relik Brown from Arizona State. I mean, those are two guys that 1,000-yard rushers. But the offensive line is still a question. I know Goolsby is going to be a top five pick, but it's kind of what, how did they work around that guy? And then it's Sark and his play calling. Sark has been unbelievable, you know, inside he's been unbelievable from the 20s. Moving up to down the field, he's got the screen game, he's got all the eye candy, the motion, all that kind of stuff. Texas has sucked in the red zone the last couple of years, and that's why the offense has kind of held back that program in some of the bigger games. They haven't been physical enough, which is why Georgia has punished them, which is why they ended up losing ultimately against Ohio State, because they couldn't score that touchdown, you know, late in the red zone. So there's a lot of pressure on Texas. There's as much pressure as it is on Lane Kiffin and LSU. It is not too dissimilar from Sark. I mean, this is another year where Sark has been given everything every other coach in the country could ask for. Will he deliver it? He hasn't won an SEC championship yet. He struggled in big games at Washington, at USC, and now at Texas. They're going to be the number one team in the country, I would presume, again, just like last year. And now they're going to have to go out and do it. And they have a tricky schedule, and they have, you know, flopped in some big games. But from the coaching staff to the roster, they have signaled that they believe that 2026 is the season that they can win a championship. I think it's a little bit different for Kalen DeBoer in Alabama, because when you do peek at some of those way too early top 25s and some of the other stuff, you got to keep scrolling. You know, this is new for Alabama fans. They ain't never had to scroll. They didn't know how to use a mouse. They just saw, oh, click. Oh, Alabama, top one of the first three teams listed. I don't have to scroll down. I don't have to click the next page. I don't have to read nothing. If this was like a Bleacher, you know, those old Bleacher Report, you know, things where you'd have to click 25 slideshows, you got to click 18, 19 times to find Alabama now. They're like ranked anywhere between 16 and 20 in all these things. And that's because look at the sheer volume of defensive production they're losing. Lawson, Jefferson, Overton's going pro. You lose a bunch of quality backups. Quay Rousseau, Smith's gone. I think it was a boon for them to get Keon Sabb to come back, but that's just one safety. That's not going to, you know, change your defense. And then you add the fact that Alabama's going to be facing – or is looking at the prospect of either starting having a first-year starter with Austin Mack or starting a guy that people believe has immense, immense upside, but is a young gun in Keon and Russell who has never yet barely taken a snap. And so that's a lot of pressure or a lot of expect. I don't even know how you would frame it. It's just not the reality that Alabama is used to. And so Kalen DeBoer, I think, is in kind of an interesting situation where Alabama fans are going to have to recalibrate expectations a little bit. So maybe he's given some grace because they realize, hey, this isn't Saban's, you know, gang squad anymore. This isn't the Monstars. It's a different deal. And Alabama has kind of, you know, receded to the pack a little bit. Or maybe they just say, hey, We want a gunner in here. We want a guy that's going to go, you know, that's going to get us back to what Saban did, even if that's not realistic. And DeBoer's out the door because Alabama's like, move on. And, you know, the history with Alabama, Mike, is interesting because they don't fire coaches all that often, but a lot of coaches leave Alabama. You know, you look through the history where it's Dennis Franchione, you got leaves for Texas A&M. I mean, there's coaches that just leave, and that's, that could be where maybe DeBoer, you know, he didn't find a landing spot with Michigan, but maybe that's a different deal next season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then how about Tennessee, who I think it's I think it's an interesting approach, but I think a different approach every year is smart, you know, based on what you got. And for Tennessee, it's, you know, it's basically the high school on offense, and then it's import everybody on defense via the portal with a new coordinator. Can that strategy work, you think?
So Tennessee is one of the more fascinating teams this offseason to me, because I think you could frame them as both a winner and a loser in the same bracket, which seems you know, counterintuitive, but follow me here. Josh Heupel, I do think, if any coach is at kind of a crossroads of what are we going to see more from? Like, I think Tennessee fans were like, hey, we loved you right at first because you weren't Jeremy Pruitt. And you cleaned up that mess about as quickly as you could, with real haste, frankly. You turned Hendon Hooker into an awesome college quarterback. We won a ton of games those first 2 years. We had that walking off against Alabama, carrying the goalpost into the Tennessee River. You lose to Georgia, okay, but you finish the season just on a super high note. You make the playoffs last year, but it was kind of underwhelming because, like, Nico really was kind of frustrating, and the defense carried you. And then we tried to get all big and bad, you know, when we went to Ohio State, and we took our shirts off, and it turns out we didn't ever come out in the locker room. You know, we were just cold. It's just cold. We tried to pretend like it wasn't cold, and it was freezing. And then last season was kind of, frankly, odd, because you look at the raw numbers that Joey Aguilar put up, and they were impressive, just raw stats. But the eye test said something's missing. Something's missing. Like, there's just a, for whatever reason, you know, in some of these games, something was missing. And the defense had again, major regression there, which is why he moved on. So what did Heupel do? He said, all right, I'm going to fix it. We're going to get more physical. So super impressive hire, you know, poaching Indiana's strength and conditioning coach, a guy who'd been with Cignetti for a long time. Indiana would hit people. Indiana was physical. That wasn't a problem. Okay, so you get those guys. We're going to go get old on defense. Like you said, we're going to get a guy who runs a really complicated system in Jim Knowles, but we're going to bring several of his guys with him from Penn State. We're going to pay a pretty penny to bring some guys that know the system, that have familiarity. And then we're going to go pluck some other guy. Oh, get a nice safety here. We're going to get another edge rusher there. So I like a lot of what they've done there. You cannot talk me into this quarterback room as being anything but an uncertainty. Tennessee fans were in my mentions when I kind of – this was about a week or 10 days ago, I think, when I was doing some offseason research and kind of noted that, you know, I think Tennessee is a fascinating team because I think you can frame them as a winner and a loser in the same light. And I said quarterback uncertainty, and I did parentheses, you know, the kid that they got from Staub, the kid they got from Colorado. And I just said, question mark, question mark, question. And Tennessee fans jumped him. Oh, Jesse, you're an idiot. Yeah, you know, they're not starting him. Who you really think they're starting him? And I said, that's not what I said. I said, it's just, it's interesting that's what they landed on. When you got a guy in Brendan Sorsby who's got, you know, family right in Knoxville, that never came, you know, happened. You clearly, you know, had a aggressive courtship and flirtation with Sam Levitt, swung and missed there. And that's who you landed on. And whether he is an insurance policy or a backup, you can't talk me into the fact, or can't convince me otherwise, that Tennessee faces real question mark at the quarterback position. Yes, it is revisionist history to say, well, if Nico had been here this past season, this is exactly, you know, the step that Tennessee was going to take, that it was going to either be McIntyre or, you know, the freshman was going to be, you know, the heir apparent. Well, okay, but Nico wasn't there, and you went out and got a guy in Joey Aguilar that you decided, we didn't think McIntyre was good enough yet, and then he still didn't gain the weight, and now we're really unsure, but now we're going to go with a freshman who's super talented Faisal? I forget how to pronounce his name.
Faison.
Yeah, Faison. But we're unsure if he's ready to play in what I think you could make the case is a make or break season for Josh Heupel because of how it ended. You know, you lose to Vanderbilt to end the regular season. It's just Tennessee is it's going to be fascinating if all those pieces can come together. If, you know, Heupel has proven he can get really good production from really any quarterback, but the defense, can they kind of coalesce quickly enough? And can he actually get that sort of production with limited turnovers from either a guy, you know, in McIntyre who hadn't played a lot, or a, you know, a five-star true freshman that's going to be facing, you know, some probably, you know, natural growing pains. I mean, look how long it took Arch Manning to finally get comfortable. And he'd been in that system for 4 years, mm-hmm. you know, expecting some of these, you know, true freshmen to just start and win immediately. I just think in today's age is a tall task. There's a reason you see the Miamis and the LSUs, you know, or Lane Kiffin, I should say, but going with veterans, you know, doing the, we're not going to develop the high school kid out of court, the quarterback out of high school. We're going to go get a guy who's 23 years old and experienced and has played a ton of football, because we believe, hell, Carson Beck didn't even need spring practice and Miami got to the national championship. I mean, there is a case that just going older at quarterback may be the new kind of model that I think a lot of these teams go for. And that's not what Tennessee obviously did this offseason.
Yeah, and it goes back to kind of what you were saying about Alabama maybe resetting expectations. I don't know how realistic that is, but I think a lot of people need to do it, because with a 9-game SEC now, and there's only one bye, I mean, you could conceivably go 5-4 in conference and only get to 8-4 overall. And I'm not saying 8-4 is like some fantastic year, but it's not necessarily a bad year either. I mean, I don't know that we should be firing everybody, whether it's Alabama or Tennessee or, you know, maybe if you're top 10, that's a different story, but 8-4 is not necessarily a god awful year, is it?
No. And that, to your point, because of the 9-game schedule, everybody is going to have to recalibrate expectations. I mean, I don't think anyone thought that 16-0 was possible in this era with the 12-team playoff and just the sheer volume of attrition teams go through running through these, you know, loaded conference slates. And so I think the recalibration for most teams, all right, you're not going to have an undefeated season. Is 10-2 good enough? You know, is 11-1 the new marker in terms of a regular season? I think the old 9-3 is 8-4. To your point, it's 8-4. And so, yes, there probably should be some patience for a lot of these programs if their coach goes 8-4. But a lot of fans, man, you know, the 8-4, I mean, in their minds, it's, you know, Texas 8-4 in them. You know, that right. Texas A&M couldn't, it was always 8-4. And so that can't be good enough. You know, if Texas A&M is firing coaches over 8-4, you know, we're Alabama. We sure as hell are going to be looking for a new coach at 8-4. And that just might not be the reality of kind of the situation anymore.
Mm-hmm. Hey, I thought of this question this morning. I really wanted to ask you about Georgia under Kirby Smart, where they have not attacked the portal too heavily this cycle. Quite frankly, I think it's because they don't necessarily need to, but football is always been kind of a game of trends, right? And now the trend is to go to the portal, shore up your deficiencies, whereas Kirby is kind of going a slightly different route, even though I know they used the portal last cycle, but this is more of a, you know, we have recruited at an elite level. We like what we got. Is this an opportunity, you think, to buck a trend and for Georgia to prove there's another way to do it? Or is he maybe being a little too Dabo-ish here and not getting enough portal guys?
See, I wouldn't put Kirby in the Dabo category, because I do think that Georgia's maybe kind of, you know, you try to middle it in a bet sometimes. It's not a smart thing to do. It's a risk. But, you know, the initial line comes out and it's say for the Super Bowl. All right, I like Seattle. I'm gonna grab the 4.5. And then that line's now moving. It's 5.5. It could go to 6. Well, you could end up, you know, you see these sharps come in and then they'll flip the other side and they'll say, hey, you know, well, I'll grab New England at 6 if it gets there, 6.5. And then they basically, you know, you try to middle it. I think that's what Georgia is doing with the transfer portal, because I do think when you look at the guys they have brought in, you bring in the receiver from Georgia Tech, Cannon, who's a really good player. You bring in, you know, several safeties. They got a kid. They have a couple, you know, safeties or defensive backs to kind of put around KJ Bolden and some other guys. And then, frankly, they have, you could make the case, because they had one of the younger rosters in the country this past season, that they were a year early, that they thought that they were a year early, and they retained almost all those guys. This wasn't a, hey, we're going to let Damon Wilson walk situation 2.0. They kept Chris Cole. They kept Justin Williams. They kept a lot of these blue chip defensive players, you know, that were former five stars. And then they signed a five-star offensive tackle. I think everything about Georgia right now for the 2026 season, they kept Nate Frazier. Ohio State's coming after Nate Frazier. You know, they kept, I think everything for Georgia centers around Gunnar Stockton's development. Can he become a more consistent downfield passer? And if he can, I think Georgia is and should be on the short list of teams for to win the national championship. I think it would, you know, they're on that very, very short list. If he can't, you're looking at a similar situation to this year where you're kind of playing playoff bracket roulette. Do you catch a break? Are you in a good spot? Or, you know, it doesn't fall your way and you lose in round one or the quarterfinals or semifinals again. Because Gunnar was good last season, but he wasn't good enough. And it good enough was specifically around making downfield throws, you know, 10 plus air yards, 20 plus air yards, throwing it when teams know you have to throw it as just a traditional drop back passer. And I think that's the development piece that Georgia needs to kind of take that final hurdle, because Kirby is doing it a little bit differently, but he hasn't completely ignored the portal like Dabo. They have at least spot, you know, grab guys in spots to at least, all right, we're going to fill this little hole. We're going to check off this, you know, bark here. But I think their ultimate upside and their ultimate ceiling next fall is going to totally center around what sort of quarterback, what version of Gunnar Stockton do we get in year two?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you, Jesse, he completed the pass when he needed to against Tennessee. I don't know why he couldn't do it the rest of the year, but he got that one in on us.
That was one of the throws of the year right there, man.
All right, Ed, one last thing. First-year coaches in the SEC. Let's remove Lane Kiffin from the equation just because he's so experienced. He's now onto his third head coaching job in the SEC. So we got Pete Golding at Ole Miss, John Summerall at Florida, Alex Golish at Auburn, Will Stein at Kentucky, and Ryan Silver, we call him Fox, Silver Fox at Arkansas. Which first-year coach do you think will have the best debut season in 26?
I think the easy answer for a lot of folks would be Pete Golding because of what LSU or what Ole Miss returns. If they get Trinidad back, they're going to be a preseason top 10 team. Pete Golding's first two games as a head coach, he wins two playoff games. He beats Kirby Smart in Georgia. They were right there in a dogfight with Miami to play for the national championship that Lane didn't think was possible. But I'm going to go with John Summerall. And it might be a little off the board, but I really like what Florida's done this offseason. They've done it quietly. They have not been in the headlines a ton. But when John Summerall took the job, I think there was maybe five or six guys on Florida's roster that you say, hey, we got to keep these guys. Look, Billy Napier could not coach a lick on a lot of Saturdays, but the man knew how to put together a roster. And he'd left John Summerall a nice foundation. But it was up to John in this new age of portal and NIL to make sure those guys stayed in Gainesville, to make sure they weren't playing for other teams next fall. And so when you look at the five guys he kept Wilson, he kept Vernell Brown, he kept the two defensive linemen. Yes, they lost DJ Lagway. You could make the argument that's a net neutral deal. That Lagway, if he didn't want to battle for the job, he wasn't just going to be handed the job. He didn't want to battle for the job. He wasn't going to be the right man for John Summerall's team. And so then when he brings in Philo, a kid who's put up all sorts of records, you know, in the state of Georgia, you pair him with his former offensive coordinator. I think Buster Faulkner was one of the best individual hires of the entire cycle, SEC, anywhere. I just think he's an outstanding offensive coordinator. The trick is going to be keeping him. for John. The trick is going to be making sure he's in Gainesville, you know, for more than 1 year, because it would not surprise me if Buster's a head coach in the very near future. But at least you have him for 26. You get Eric Singleton, who was underutilized at Auburn last year in just a passing attack that was non-functional. So I just like the pieces that Florida has, and the young defensive guys that Billy Napier recruited are now going to be playing, I think, in an even better system. And so the expectations in Gainesville aren't, you know, sky high yet, but I think you're going to start to see some maybe swelling momentum of a little, but who's the dark horse team? I think, Florida. Oh, who's the team that could maybe surprise some people? Florida. Who's the first year head coach in the SEC that not enough folks are talking about that maybe could sneak his way into the playoff conversation or even get there in a 12-team field? Florida. And that's not to say that we'll see about Alex Golish at Auburn. I really like what Kentucky has done. Will Stein, both the staff and kind of the guys that he's been aggressively recruiting in the portal. You know, he saw what Dan Lanning did and kind of that puzzle and said, hey, Kentucky's got money. We just ain't been spending it right. Let's spend it and use it. So I like what they've done, but I'm most interested, and I believe Florida kind of has that path. And I will say this for John too. What's kind of fascinating about how he has put this roster together vis-a-vis another first-year coach or first-year coaches, your boy Silver Fox, he took a bus of guys from Memphis. You know, he said, get on the bus and I'll drive you to Fayetteville. Alex Golish basically said, hey, we're going to take USF and we're just going to put it in the planes. I mean, he's got all his coaches. He's got all, you know, a ton of coaches. He's got like 13 or 14 players. And I'm not saying that's a wrong strategy. We've seen a lot of guys be successful recently in the NIL portal days of doing that very thing, basically taking an offensive staff or whatever. We've seen it in the SEC. I mean, you know, the New Mexico State Armada, you know, mafia group, you know, they just go to Vanderbilt. It's the coaches, it's Pavia, and boom, and Clark Lee suddenly, you know, in playoff contention. Summerall didn't do that, though. And that's what's really interesting. He only took two guys from Tulane's roster, one of the best G5 programs, you know, the last couple of years. He only deemed two guys worthy of playing in the SEC for him. He only took a couple of assistant coaches, and they do not have the same titles that they did at Tulane. He's making those guys work their way back up. Coordinator, okay, now you're a quarterback's coach. Now you're a lower assistant. I'm going to go hire a guy who's actually been a coordinator at a P5, P4 program. So I think it's just fascinating that he's kind of taken a different approach to a lot of these other first-year coaches, specifically in the SEC, but even across the country. And so I'm kind of interested and optimistic that Florida maybe is going to be a surprise team among specifically those first-year coaches in the conference.
Mm-hmm. And if I could try to get you in trouble right out the door here, more likely to make the playoff next year, Texas or Oklahoma?
Oh, that's a layup, man. That's
Oklahoma, right?
No, Red River hook 'em.
All right. Hey, Jesse Simonton, thank you so much for your time. Can you tell all the listeners how to find the Surrender Cobra Substack?
Yeah, it's on Substack. You can also find the link on my Twitter at Jesse R.E. Simonton. But yeah, come give it a follow. Come give it a read. I got videos. John Reed and I do a little pod together as well, Slow Mesh. So come check it out. It's college football. Mike does the SEC. I do a little bit of everything, but a ton of SEC content's on there. And I love chopping it up with Mike. And whenever I see, you know, cousin Shane, I enjoy my time with him too. So he's probably sipping a pina colada or a beer somewhere right now.
Oh, he definitely is. And I'll make sure to put links in all the description of everywhere you find this show to the Surrender Cobra Substack. So go check it out. Thanks again, Jesse. And can't wait for the next conversation.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Mike.